Today on Against the Grain, philosophy matters to the British thinker and educator Peter Cave and to our lives. I'm CS. We'll present for the first time the full-length interview with the author of How to Think Like a Philosopher, Scholars, Dreamers, and Sages Who Can Teach Us How to Live, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Last month, in the context of this station's fund drive, we presented portions of a conversation with Peter Cave about his new book, How to Think Like a Philosopher. Today, we present the full-length interview focusing on four heavyweights: Marx, Nietzsche, Sartre, and Arendt. Peter Cave read philosophy at University College London and King's College Cambridge, and he's held lectureships at, among other places, the Open University in the UK and New York University, London. He's written numerous books about philosophy for laypeople, including The Big Think Book, Discover Philosophy Through 99 Perplexing Problems, and Philosophy, A Beginner's Guide. Peter's new book is How to Think Like a Philosopher, Scholars, Dreamers, and Sages Who Can Teach Us How to Live. It examines the lives and ideas of 30 thinkers, among them Plato, Lao Tzu, Sappho, Kierkegaard, Heidegger, and Simone de Beauvoir. When Peter Cave joined me from the UK, I asked him about the nature of philosophical inquiry and its uses.
I think people should all engage in philosophy, if only at the minimal level of thinking about what's going on in the world and in their thinking. Bertrand Russell, the 20th century mathematician and philosopher, said, "You know, many people would rather die than think, and sadly, that is what they do." So I do encourage the idea that philosophy really is thinking, but thinking about very serious and often very, very general matters. My guess is that some people are put off philosophy because they think of it as being highly abstract, abstruse, very academic, totally inaccessible. I write these books in the hope, maybe a forlorn hope, that people may read them and realise that there can be fun in philosophy, there can be entertainment, but also philosophy is a very serious subject at times and is indeed accessible. So this latest book of mine isn't just going through some philosophical theories and some philosophers, it also is trying to bring out a touch of humour there, an element of lightness, and how they affect our everyday life. I do sometimes quip to my students when they ask that question which you asked, C.S., about philosophy, is I now realise that to be a philosopher you don't really need to know anything, you need to know how to argue. That is a bit of a quip, but there's some truth in it, namely philosophers are very keen on reasoning, but not just reasoning, also reasoning with the idea of truth as the object.
Now, Peter, some philosophers, many thinkers, write somewhat inaccessibly. How did you approach that issue in the sense of choosing thinkers, philosophers, dreamers, as in the subtitle of your book, to present in this book, to whose ideas you wanted to describe in this book?
I suppose my first thought was indeed to have the classic great philosophers with whom I grew, I suppose. Plato, Socrates before him, Aristotle, and Monsieur Descartes. That's my one bit of French pronunciation, Monsieur Descartes, Spinoza, David Hume, and Kant. But then I also thought, in order to make the book more maybe saleable, but also more interesting to many people, were they to open it and read it, of course, it would be very good to have some philosophers who are often not thought of as philosophers. So one of my chapters is on Samuel Beckett, the playwright, for example. Another one is on Lewis Carroll, who wrote the Alice in Wonderland books, but indeed raises many philosophical questions. Another one is Iris Murdoch, who, although she is a philosopher, most people think of her just as a novelist. So that was one way in which I tried to make the book more accessible. I should also hasten to say I have some philosophers there with whom I don't have any great sympathy, but again, to give a well-rounded view of philosophy and how you can disagree with philosophers whilst nonetheless trying to understand them, I do, for example, have Heidegger in, who I call the great hyphenator, because he kept on hyphenating words to make them sound far more impressive. For myself, I feel great sympathy for philosophers such as Wittgenstein, and especially for a little-known philosopher at Cambridge in the 20th century called G.E. Moore. If you would like, I'd happily say a few quick words about G.E. Moore.
Please do.
G.E. Moore, at the time, during his life, was thought as an incredibly important philosopher. Now some people think of him as, to make a quip, moronic. But he was highly influential on the Bloomsbury Group. Writers, novelists such as Virginia Woolf looked up to him. Maynard Keynes, the economist, was very impressed with him. And although Wittgenstein, who was much younger than Moore, initially thought he was a moronic, dare I say, in fact, Wittgenstein came to understand Moore as being a very, very important philosopher. The two quick examples I could give to you, which are highly accessible, and one of which is highly important, is when Moore was a young student of philosophy, of what was called moral sciences then, in Cambridge in the United Kingdom. One of the famous philosophers of some note then was John MacTaggart, Ellis MacTaggart. What a wonderful name. And MacTaggart said that time is totally unreal. There's no reality to time at all. And Moore said, "Hey Jack, are you really telling me that I didn't have my breakfast before I had my tea?" Why I think that's a highly important quip by Moore is that I think philosophers really do need to be brought down to earth. When they do use some strange claims about reality or about the nature of morality, I think it's very, very sensible to say, well, give us an example, say exactly what it is that you mean. That's one reason why I think Moore is a great philosopher and should be listened to far more, dare I say, more of Moore. But secondly, as he grew older, younger philosophers thought of him as presenting himself as a great sage, the great guru, because he would often sit in seminars saying nothing, but looking very sage-like and wise. To which at one point somebody said to him, "Moore, why didn't you say anything?" To which Moore, in complete and honest modesty, said, "Well, I couldn't think of anything to say." I approve of that as well. I think philosophers, including people such as this humble philosopher here, tend to burble on far too much. It would often be rather nice to say at times, "Actually, I don't know what to say. I can't think of anything to say at this point," instead of rushing in, as politicians do and commentators do these days, of thinking they must always have answers. I think that's a very, very unhappy aspect of our life at the moment, and I would urge the idea of do not rush in, acknowledge if you haven't got anything to say on a topic, or indeed follow Wittgenstein again, who said, "When two philosophers meet, they should say to each other, take your time." That would be my other advice then. Let's not rush into things, even though on a radio programme, a wireless programme no doubt, maybe we do a bit of rushing.
Well, you devote a chapter, 30 chapters, to 30 thinkers. And let's begin with Karl Marx. Your chapter on Marx looks first at what Hegel thought, because Marx drew heavily on Hegel, even as Marx did depart from Hegel in many respects. What was Hegel's understanding of how history unfolded?
Hegel is one of those philosophers whom I find very, very difficult. And I suppose that's one reason why I did not devote a whole chapter to Hegel. Indeed, Hegel would deserve 4 or 5 chapters if we were looking at him properly. But Hegel did have this idea of this mind or the spirit or the Geist in which somehow or other history unfolds through dialectic, through putting forward something, then the opposite comes about, and then there's a synthesis. I find it very, very difficult to see how that works, either in theory or in practice, but undoubtedly that is what Hegel thought. And he seems to have thought that the great synthesis I just happened to arrive there during the late 18th, early 19th century when Hegel was around, which seems highly implausible. What Marx got from Hegel, though, was let's not lapse into talk about spirits and the world mind or the self, whatever it's meant to be. I, Karl Marx, want to bring philosophy down to the ground and recognize we should be talking about human beings, flesh and blood creatures, here on the in the world. And for Marx, he saw their development as heading through a sequence of events based on the changes in the economics, based on the changes in how people related to each other through the modes of production. So his similarity with Hegel is purely that he saw history as unfolding, as there being an end towards which it aimed, but he certainly did not see it in terms of some spiritual end in view. He saw it as, in fact, a way in which the role of production, the material forces and so forth, would give rise to another structure, which would give rise to another structure. And as you know, he strangely thought that in the end it would lead to some version of communism. But Marx himself was humble enough to say, don't keep asking me about what will happen in the end, in the very end. I'm not a cook. I don't have recipes for history. I just am predicting at the moment how things will unfold. He seems to have got some aspects of it wrong, but he certainly got some aspects of it right.
Peter Cave joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. He is a philosopher, writer, and lecturer. We are talking about his new book, How to Think Like a Philosopher: Scholars, Dreamers, and Sages Who Can Teach Us How to Live. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And Marx wrote that life is not determined by consciousness, but consciousness by life. Is this a reference to what you were saying about material conditions mattering and economic conditions mattering a whole lot to Marx, much more than some sort of a generalized spirit or, again, a world mind?
Yes, indeed, C.S., that's the exact point which Marx would be making. Marx would claim that ideas, ideas of political rights, for example, or ideas of morality, were all brought about through the material forces, through the modes of production, as he termed it, which change, of course, from the slave society to feudalism to capitalism. And he thought, therefore, that the idea of human rights, the idea that we could start, say, talking about equality and so forth, all these thoughts and ideas were derived from the different ways in which the material productions were working. And he thought that because of the way in which capitalism was working, which at his time, of course, was highly unregulated, it was very much a matter of powerful bodies maximizing profit and giving the workers a pretty bad time. On that basis, then Marx did predict there will be a great revolution. In a sense, his was a self-defeating prophecy because, of course, as the powers that be came to realize that there was this sort of danger, then governments did start to introduce regulations, did start to introduce minimum wages and so forth. So as a matter of fact, in many Western societies, things have gone much better, possibly because of principles and ideas and predictions of someone such as Karl Marx.
Although it would be fair to say, wouldn't it, that regulation, with a capital R, has seen its better days, that deregulation has been the order of the day for a number of decades now.
You're certainly right. I have taken the idea of the last 100 years in which regulation started increasing, and then you're totally right, in the last 2 or 3 decades, particularly in the States and in Britain, there's been a lot of deregulation on the go. And so one way of looking at that is also to see how the global capitalism, in fact, has had adverse effects on many other societies, many other countries. So, for example, people still in Africa, kids are still scrabbling around trying to get the cobalt out so it could then be delivered to China, which is then making our mobile phones for Apple and so forth. So, in fact, we are living off the corruption of what goes on in Africa and India and in China to the benefit of many, many people in the West. Let's also remember, though, that many, many people in the West are not the middle classes, the wealthy. There are millions of people in the States and in Europe who are incredibly poor. It tends not to be very well known amongst the middle classes in the States, but in fact the United States has a much higher infant mortality than most countries in Europe. It's appalling that way. Or the case of life expectancy for the poorest is much worse in the States than in countries where there is not such vast inequalities. So yes, in the States, if things are going very well, you can do very well, you can have a very long life, and you can be pretty healthy, though you'll spend lots of money on unnecessary investigations, whereas in the Europe, where you have not so much with regard to inequalities, the poorest tend to do better than the poorest in the States. That's why some people would argue that the gross inequalities of wealth is one of the causes for many people at the lower end of society to have a pretty bad time, and quite significantly so a bad time. I know some economists with regard to Britain, which follows the States, and the States tend to think of them, in fact, they're very, very poor countries, but with a few incredibly wealthy people. Whereas, say, take Norway, that's a pretty wealthy country, but in fact, the poorest in Norway do far better, arguably because there are not such gross inequalities between the poor and the rich in Norway, or indeed in Denmark and so forth.
You spend a good chunk of your chapter on Marx addressing the notion, his notion of alienation. What did Marx mean by alienation? And I see that you consider it first in the context of religion.
Yes, alienation I would think of from Marx as his most important point. And it also relates to how I make the quip, as Marx does, that we should take off the cap. He thinks that we are often trying to deceive ourselves. We're not prepared to face the monsters which are going on in our society. I've already alluded to one monster, namely how we in fact mistreat the very, very poorest of people in the world by them scrabbling around to make a few pence in order to supply ultimately the mobile telephones or the computers. But the alienation which Marx can also be used for is to point out that many people, he thought, do end up thinking things are pretty bad down here in this world, but there's an afterlife when God will make everything work out. Justice will prevail. So that's where we get the quip about religion is managing to overcome the suffering in the world, the opium of the masses, to make the famous comment. But Marx would not want us to think that there wasn't the suffering. He doesn't think that the religion works. People are still suffering, but they are trying to overcome it by thinking of this future life when justice will prevail. Marx, of course, thinks there's no good reason to believe in such a future life, as indeed do many other philosophers. David Hume, if we had a chance to talk about him, was a fine 18th century philosopher who was very, very good at puncturing the ideas of religious belief. But returning to Marx, his alienation with regard to the material world would be how, during his time, of course, the workers, the people actually doing the hard work, were earning very little, and they could only be filled with envy at those people who were able to buy what these workers were in fact contributing to. And although that doesn't continue so much today in Britain or in the States, it still continues a fair bit. There's quite a few millions of people who in fact are working very hard because they aspire to what governments and the powers that be try to persuade us that they want. So they would like to have another car or greater trinkets. And some people actually say, oh, this is just manifesting the typical envy of Marxists, the typical envy of the left wing. But I would like to remind them that Adam Smith, the great guru for capitalism and free markets, Adam Smith, the Scottish philosopher, friend of David Hume in the 18th century, he himself drew attention to how capitalism led to this huge amount of time and trouble producing little trinkets, and then people becoming envious because they want trinkets too, or bracelets, or the latest gold watch, or in our day, the latest mobile phone. So this consumerism, Marx would certainly see as a form of alienation. And it's more than that, though. He would talk about how we are playthings of forces beyond us. We can see that because think in the 2008-09, the great banking crisis, how everybody became at the mercy of what was going on. they seem to lack control. Or think how today, if you want to be part of society, you do need to have a mobile phone, you do need to be on the internet. So some people get excluded. So we are indeed playthings of more powerful forces. And we can see that just through international economics today.
Marx, as you point out in this chapter in your book, wants freedom. What sort of freedom does Marx aspire to for people as individuals and for people as in the human race?
I'm not sure how to make sense of that distinction, but I shall work on it. Certainly, I think for individuals, Marx, but let's bring it up to date. Today, I think we'd recognize that many people pretend or believe, sincerely believe, that they are free, but in fact, they are being manipulated by the advertising and marketing. I wonder how many people really, truly thought they really must have that latest sort of designer handbag or those latest sorts of trainers, were it not for the wonderful marketing ability of great corporations who are indeed seeking out profit. I find it quite paradoxical that here in Britain, and I suspect also in the States, if governments just say, oh, we want to recommend that people do not eat so much sugar or have so much salt for their health, or we'd like to try to dissuade people from gambling so much. Here, many people say, oh, that's the dreadful nanny state. How dare the nanny state start nannying us, telling us how we ought to behave? So many people, particularly on the right, think of the nanny state as indeed something dreadful, because the state tends to advise you about how is the best way for your health, for example. Curiously, though, they say nothing at all about how corporations are forever trying to manipulate you and not necessarily for your best interests at all. The state, so-called nannying, at least is having a concern for your health. The corporate bodies who are persuading you to eat more and more sickly cream buns or to start spending more and more money gambling, they do not have your interests at heart. They have the interests of their profits, their CEOs and their shareholders at heart. So Marx would really be wanting to find a society, it's not clear how we would, in which our wants and our desires were not distorted in that way, but in which we were actually in control of our own choices. What constitutes that control, of course, is very difficult to identify, because if you are someone, such as I am, to believe there's going to be explanations back in the biological world about what you do and think, then we need quite a bit of argument to sort out what will count as constituting some free choices. But Marx did have this wonderful idea that I guess he thought that through technological advances, people would be free enough in the sense of to choose how they would want to live. So he says, I'd like to see a state in which somebody could be a hunter in the morning, a fisherman in the afternoon, could do a bit of cattle rearing in the evening and engage in philosophical discussion late at night without becoming a hunter or a fisherman. In other words, he didn't want one to be stereotyped into saying, I am a hunter, or I am a fisherman, or I am a cleaner. He wanted people to be free in the sense they could choose how to conduct their lives in different ways and in a great variety of ways. That does seem radically idealistic, but it isn't something we should condemn. It's a nice idea.
I'm CS. The program is Against the Grain. I'm joined by the British philosopher, educator, and writer Peter Cave, whose new book is How to Think Like a Philosopher: Scholars, Dreamers, and Sages Who Can Teach Us How to Live. Let's move on to Nietzsche, another 19th century thinker. Nietzsche was born in 1844 and died in 1900. Why is Nietzsche considered an existentialist? And here I guess we need to get some sort of a definition of what existentialism is.
I'm tempted immediately to answer by a great Wittgenstein quip, don't ask for the definition, ask for the use. I'm very wary of giving definitions. If you are working in mathematics, you can define what a circle is, you can define what a prime number is. But once we are engaged in theories and engaged in everyday life, it becomes far more difficult to think we're going to get very far with formal definitions. An example I frequently give, not a controversial example, is take the colour spectrum, red, orange, yellow, green, blue and so on. Can anyone say where red really ends and orange begins? We can talk about wavelengths and so on, but in fact they are vague concepts. They are fuzzy edges. And I'd say that with regard to existentialism. To the extent to which I think we can start edging towards the definition of existentialism, say, well, if we look at the use of the term, then those individuals who have got classified as existentialists have tended to be those who very much want to press home on us that we have the responsibility about how to conduct our lives and how to decide or choose how we view what is right and wrong. Indeed, if there is any right or wrong. So we ought not to try to pass the moral buck, as I call it, onto someone else and say, oh, morality is determined by reason, or morality is determined by Jesus Christ, or morality is told us courtesy of Mohammed. We should recognise that we are free agents in the sense that we have to choose how to live, how to choose our lives. And although that isn't very easy to grasp when you think that, as I've already implied, maybe what we do and say has been physically determined, as indeed Nietzsche tended to believe, what that doesn't tell us, though, is how we interpret that. As I often quip, even if you recognise that you are physically determined to behave in certain ways, that isn't going to tell you what to do today, whether you should put on your red dress or your blue dress, whether you should do a radio interview with CS or not. You still have to make these choices, and you are responsible for those choices. That is what Nietzsche would certainly be promoting, and that's what another existentialist would be, such as Sartre. But yes, the term existentialism only came into play in the 20th century, and then it was passed over onto Nietzsche or onto the great Danish philosopher Kierkegaard. They both would therefore be explaining to us, stressing to us, that we cannot keep on saying, it's somebody else's fault why I'm behaving this way. We need to interpret our own actions and take responsibility for them. On that point of interpretation, I've reminded myself of a quip by Søren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher I've just mentioned, in which he saw a new shop had opened near where he lived. It said, bring your washing here. So Kierkegaard rushed off home, collected together his dirty washing and taken his dirty washing to this new laundry, as he thought of it, and then he suddenly realised it wasn't a shop, a laundry, it was in fact a shop selling signs such as bring your washing here. So Kierkegaard, but indeed Nietzsche and indeed Sartre, would be stressing very much that how we behave depends in part on how we interpret our surroundings and also interpret our own behaviour.
You write about Nietzsche's insistence that we need to give meaning to our lives. What sort of meaning, what would constitute meaning in Nietzsche's eyes?
I think that's a very fine question, and as you may have noticed with my answers to your other questions, C.S., I tend to get round to them by some deviant route. The route I've just remembered here is a nice little dialogue, mini short dialogue, between Simone de Beauvoir, another one of my philosophers, another one who tends to be thought of as a novelist, and Simone Weil, who is often thought as a more spiritualist, rather strange religious believer, though she too is a philosopher. They were both talking in the 1930s, both French, and Simone de Beauvoir was saying, oh, I was talking to Simone Weil, and she was always going on about how she wanted to feed the hungry, feed the world, to which I said to Simone Weil, you know, what's important in life is for people to find meaning to their lives. To which Simone Weil responded, which I thought very, very well, saying, I can tell, Simone de Beauvoir, you have never gone hungry. I do then want to stress that what's important then is for us to recognise that it's rather luxurious for us to start wondering about the meaning of our lives. But yes, if you are in the comfort of a secure job or secure income and so forth, then yes, we are in that position. And Nietzsche put forward what he called the greatest weight. He said, suppose in the middle of the night a demon were to speak unto you and tell you that this life which you are living will have to be repeated again and again and again eternally, exactly as it is right now. Everything you've done to date will be repeated again and again. Exactly the same. You won't have a feeling of deja vu. The good things in your life as you perceive them, the bad things in your life as you perceive them, will just be repeated to an eternity. And then Nietzsche asks, suppose you heard that, would you not gnash your teeth, fall to the ground, and think what a dreadful idea? How well disposed could I be to my life to have it repeated again and again forever? Or could I be so well disposed to my life that I would welcome this idea as an accolade for my life? So Nietzsche here is trying to get us to think seriously about what sort of life are we proud to live? What sort of life do we value? And let's pretend it's going to be repeated again and again. The metaphysics of a life being repeated again and again in exactly the same way is arguably a nonsense, because it would just be one life then. How could it be exactly the same and yet different? But somehow that thought of Nietzsche has often led many philosophers, many people who just are non-philosophers but just dip into Nietzsche, who realise, yes, there's something very important here. Am I so proud of my life that I could stand up and defend it? I suspect many of us would feel rather ashamed of our lives in certain respects and would feel we could do better. Nietzsche does in fact make the quip that no one really wants happiness. Well, only the Englishman seeks happiness. I think he was quipping against Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill in the 19th century. And it shows he didn't really read John Stuart Mill all that closely, because although Mill does talk about happiness, he does recognise in happiness very important ideas about feelings of shame, feelings of pride, feelings of gratitude and so forth. So it's not just the idea of simple pleasures. But Nietzsche's thought is very important to try to draw us away from thinking, oh, all that matters in my life is just to have a sequence of pleasures. Would you really value such a life for yourself, or if you have children, for your children? An example I sometimes use, it's taken from Plato, a little bit distorted by me, is to say, if pleasure is all that you really value in life, then all you need to do is buy some itching powder and a back scratcher. Sprinkle the itching powder on your back and scratch. You have the itch, then you have the wonderful, delightful pleasure of the scratching. Repeat time and time again. Wouldn't we see that, in fact, that would not be a good human life? That isn't something which many human beings, if any, would truly value. And that's the point, I think, that Nietzsche is making. You need to stand up for your life and try to make something good of it. Another feature of that, though, is that Nietzsche will stress it's up to you what you perceive as being good of your life. And another, even more important feature of Nietzsche is based on an old maxim, an old mantra from ancient Greece, namely, all things conspire. Nietzsche was very, very well aware, and this is why he wondered how one could live, how one could be well disposed to your life, because he was well aware, as we should be today, that our lives do depend in part on immense sufferings of others. And Nietzsche would say, how could we live at all if there was just one suffering of somebody else which we relied on in order for us to live? Or how well disposed could we be to our life? How courageous could we be to overcome that and think I can still value my life and really be pleased about it such that it could be repeated? I do want to stress that point again, and many of us try to evade it. I'm as bad as all of us, really. But it is true that all our lives, in which we have a reasonable level of wealth or income and so forth, we are dependent on the lives of others who have suffered considerably. And of course, not just human beings, also non-human animals. I feel very, very guilty because I am not a vegetarian. I do eat meat, but I do feel guilty when I do it. I can never decide, does that make me worse than somebody who in fact does eat meat and doesn't feel at all guilty about it and doesn't mind about it? I suspect I'm worse because I'm so weak-willed. But again, how well disposed could I be to my life to embrace that weakness?
His name is Peter Cave. He is a popular philosophy writer and lecturer, a lecturer at the Open University in the UK and at New York University, London. He's written numerous books about philosophy. His new book is How to Think Like a Philosopher, scholars, dreamers, and sages who can teach us how to live. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Nietzsche famously, or maybe infamously, rejected the type of people who are good, kind, and charitable. He saw that as a weakness in certain respects. And in Thus Spake Zarathustra, perhaps his most famous book, he brings up the figure of the Übermensch, sometimes translated as Superman, a being who affirms life, who values greatness. What do you make of what Nietzsche is saying about what we ought to aspire to in terms of greatness, and whether kind of maybe conventional understandings of what is good and kind ought to be subverted, ought to be interrogated?
Thinking more about Nietzsche, I do think that his idea of the Übermensch is highly important and something we ought not just to dismiss. Let's remember that Nietzsche, in fact, is trying to reject traditional morality, which he thinks of as based in Christianity and religion. One of his main points here is to say, as he does in this quippy way, God is dead. Once we are into an era in which people acknowledge that there is no God, or in which people do not take religion seriously, and that's true of millions of people today, but I recognize that billions of people probably do take religion seriously. But for those who do not, they do not then have some sort of morality which they can refer to as outside. We are now back at the existentialist consideration about how you have to choose your own values. How well disposed could you be to your life? Nietzsche thought that one particular value which got entwined through religion was very much this of valuing pity, of valuing the weak, and so forth. Nietzsche thought he should try to be courageous enough and strong enough to live a good life without being so overwhelmed, consumed by the concern about the suffering of others. All of us, including UCS, including me, we are involved in the immense sufferings of many other human beings and many other non-human creatures. So, what is to be done? Nietzsche thought that what is possible for a human being, or maybe an Übermensch, somebody who goes beyond human beings, would be to be able to embrace life in such a way, with such importance, that they could welcome their lives, they could be proud of their lives, they could be courageous with their lives, without being forever distorted, as you would say it, by the sympathy and the corruptions around us because of the sufferings of others. That is a noble idea, I think, except it still leaves all those others in a pretty bad way. So I'd be more inclined to think, wouldn't it be a nicer way to be well disposed to your life if you could try to do more for those others rather than ignoring them? What's also true in Nietzsche, and again I've forgotten to mention this, but it's also true of some other philosophers, and we find this in Wittgenstein, in that maybe the greatest way in which we become true to ourselves, we come to have a sense of self, is when paradoxically we lose ourself in music. Wittgenstein certainly saw this in terms of, you know, he very much appreciated Beethoven and Schubert and so forth, and Nietzsche wondered how one could live a life without music. And as I'm sure you know, he was very, very impressed with the Wagnerian music at various points, and then went off it, hugely so, when he saw it as falling into the myth of the Christianity. But yes, the Übermensch, I think, is important. It's something to aspire to, but I think we could aspire to being the Übermensch by, in fact, showing far more consideration for other creatures around us, other people, instead of, in a sense, trying to overcome them and ignoring them.
On this issue of existentialism, let us talk a little bit about Jean-Paul Sartre. I guess a lot of people in this country would pronounce his name Sartre. He talked a lot about freedom, freedom to choose how to view and deal with our situations. And he believed that we are, in a sense, condemned to be free. What does he mean by this, and what does this have to do with his understanding of something he called nothingness?
Nothingness is a wonderful concept which indeed Sartre does deploy. One way of approaching it is just to think of a little quip which is made about Sartre. Sartre goes into a cafe and the waiter says to Sartre, "What would you like to drink?" And Sartre says, "Yes, I'd like to have a coffee and with sugar, no cream." The waiter goes off and then he returns looking terribly, terribly worried. "Oh dear, monsieur, we haven't got any cream and we do have milk. Would you like to have coffee with sugar and no milk?" That is humorous to philosophers who know about Sartre, because Sartre thought it's the absence of things which needs to be explained. And that may seem incredibly abstract, but in fact there's some great real problems there. It goes back to Parmenides, an ancient Greek philosopher, and Zeno, who gave his different paradoxes. But the question is, how can you talk about things which do not exist? Things in the past do not exist now, so how are we able to talk about things in the past? When there was a young Wittgenstein in Cambridge in the 1910s and 20s, Bertrand Russell was trying to tell Wittgenstein that, yes, it is true, there is not a hippopotamus in this room. But Wittgenstein would have none of that, because it's talking about something which does not exist. How can it be true that there is not something there? And Russell said, "I looked under tables and chairs to show Ludwig Wittgenstein there was no hippopotamus, but he still wouldn't have it that it was true there was no hippopotamus in the room." One problem there is, how would you distinguish between the lack of the hippopotamus as opposed to the lack of a mouse or the lack of a rhinoceros? That's why I also introduced Lewis Carroll as one of my great philosophers in this book, because Lewis Carroll, the author of the Alice stories, some of your listeners may well know that he tells of the White King asking Alice, "Whom did you pass on the road?" "Nobody," said Alice. "Ah," says the White King, "to be able to see nobody, and from this distance too." And so he gets into muddles about non-existence. I've lapsed there into various metaphysical issues about non-existence, why it's particularly important to Sartre in his expression of nothingness, is that he wants to insist that at the heart of human beings, their essence is they have no essence. If you like, the essence is nothing, no thing. When we think about other items in the world, when we think about tables and chairs or pen knives and knives and forks, they do have a function. We know what they are for. Sartre wants to stress that human beings have no function. You cannot say, "Oh, I'm a tailor, so I'm here in order to mend the clothing or to create some wonderful tunics." And he gives a famous example of bad faith, in which somebody who's a waiter, speaking loosely, might say, "I'm a waiter, and so this is why I behave in this way, this is why I take tips, this is why I do this to the customers," and so forth. Sartre wants to stress, you are not a waiter. No person is a waiter. You may choose to do some waiting for a living, but you're not to evade responsibility by saying you are a waiter. And he would hence condemn religious believers who would say, "Well, I'm a child of God, and so I've got to behave in this way because the Catholic Church tells me so, or because Islam tells me so." Sartre will say that's bad faith. You are trying to evade your responsibility. And it comes down then to how you interpret your behaviour. He does give some rather poignant examples. Somebody may be disabled. You may think, "Well, surely he's not free to go jumping around." Well, that's true, but he may well be free as to how he looks at his disablement and how he tries to view it and treat it. Does he treat it as something to overcome or something to be filled with despair over, and so forth? Sartre's famous book, Being a Nothingness, does then have some wonderful examples in which people are trying to evade their responsibility for the sort of people they are. And Sartre will come back to saying it's up to you how you live your life. It's up to you how you interpret your actions. And don't keep on trying to pass the buck to someone else. Then there's one other thing I really feel I must say about Sartre. He talks about how we are prey to the living, prey to the other, as if we are at their mercy. Whilst we are still living, of course, we at least can reinterpret our lives. We can try to make amends if we feel guilty about something, or if we feel remorse. Once we are dead, then we're trapped. then indeed people can go around reassessing us, and that's why he would talk about how we can be prey to the living once we are no more. And that's quite a powerful thought if we relate it back to Nietzsche about how well disposed could we be to our lives. Well, how would you like your life to be viewed once you were no more? I know that some people say, oh, well, that doesn't matter at all. Why should anything matter to me once I'm dead? I'd very much challenge that, because you are worried about your reputation. You are worried whether people follow the terms of your will. And so I, as indeed some other philosophers would say, we ought not to think that when death is there, we are not. When we are dead, yes, the biological body isn't there. There's no mind, there's no spirit. But nonetheless, how you are treated can be relevant to the sort of person you ended up being. And Sartre is making that point when he says, on death, you are prey to the other.
Another chapter in your book, How to Think Like a Philosopher, is devoted to Hannah Arendt. The very influential 20th century philosopher died in 1975. What did Hannah Arendt mean by thinking without a banister?
I think I mentioned earlier on about how I included some philosophers because I know that they were well thought of and people were very impressed with their work. I'm afraid that Hannah Arendt comes to my mind as one of these in which I still remain a bit puzzled why she is thought of as being so very, very important. Over the point about thinking without the banister, I think she is very keen to stress, as I've already said at the beginning of this talk, about how you do need to think for yourself and not just follow the regimentations around you. In fact, at one point, I think she says something about evil occurs because of the failure to think. That's a typical aphorism which a philosopher might say, which I then highly criticize. It's not just a matter of how to think. It's a matter of thinking correctly. Because as we know, there has been lots of thinking, e.g. during the 1930s in Germany, which led to dreadful evils. So presumably Hannah Arendt meant to think well, or to think with concern, or to think aiming at the truth. So she is important, though, in that she was thought of as a pariah at various stages in her life. She was a pariah when she was in Germany because she was Jewish, and she was Jewish, of course. Some of the Jewish community, though, then turned her into a pariah when she was in Germany because she started to question the activities of the Zionists, of whether it was right for Israel to take over parts of Palestine and so forth, so that she got condemned in that way. She was then condemned again when she was in New York because she spoke, as I'm sure many people here know, about the banality of evil when she was discussing Eichmann at his trial for the war crimes and genocides. I think she was unfairly criticized there. I think she was arguing reasonably well that lots of nasty things can come about through bureaucracies. That is why she is important, to the extent that some of her works are very much stressing how many evils come around because people are just following orders, they're just following the technocrats and so forth. So that's a good point in her philosophy. Another good point, which I find very attractive, is that she was prepared to stand up with courage and say what she thought. So in the 1950s, in Little Rock, Arkansas, there's a desegregation policy going on in which the police came around to insist that this school could not be segregated. To the amazement of most people, Arendt opposed this. She said, why shouldn't there be segregation in schools? I think she was wrong, but at least she did have the courage to stand up for that, in which she seemed to be arguing for what, to my mind, is a very iffy distinction between the social and the political. She thought that in the political space, everyone should be treated equally, should have equal rights and so forth. But once you are in the social space, then you can rightly discriminate. And of course, we do accept that to some degree. Namely, surely I can be free to say I prefer blondes to brunettes, or surely I can be free to say I prefer a woman or a man who is very much involved in philosophy than a woman or a man who is only involved in football or baseball. So within the society of our intimate relationships, we do acknowledge discriminations, and I think we should. The question is, how far does that go along the line? And that's a very big problem. That's again why I said earlier on that we should resist definitions and should acknowledge that lots of ideas have fuzzy edges. Often I therefore write in terms about how we muddle through. We muddle through because we have conflicting values. In the political realm, according to Hannah Arendt, there should be complete equality and rights and so forth. But once we enter society, such as education in that particular case, then it seems that there doesn't have to be such non-discrimination. Where do we draw those lines? She didn't want to draw the line and say that you could insist that black people had to sit in this part of the bus, not in that part. She is highly opposed to that. But at that time, she seemed prepared to accept the segregation in schools. I suspect she then changed her mind, I don't know. So I approve of her to the extent that she raises some awkward issues, but I tend to disapprove of the great acclaim she now receives, because when she talks about politics, it does strike me as not at all clear quite which points she's trying to make. She's very, very keen to object to consequentialism. She seems to object to utilitarianism. She seems to think that action should take part in a collective space, but then quite what is meant to be decided upon, it seems very unclear. But that she raises those issues, I think, is incredibly important.
Peter Cave, philosopher, writer, lecturer. He's written numerous books, including The Big Think Book, Discover Philosophy Through 99 Perplexing Problems, Philosophy, A Beginner's Guide, and This Sentence is False, An Introduction to Philosophical Paradoxes. We've been talking about his new book, How to Think Like a Philosopher, Scholars, Dreamers, and Sages Who Can Teach Us How to Live. Thank you, Peter, very much for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, C.S. I very much enjoyed it.
And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.